A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Welcome back to my weird prompts. So this week, we got a prompt from Hannah, and I want you to picture something. It's 11 at night, you're pulling back the covers, and there it is, a single grain of rice, on your pillow. 3 days after you served rice for dinner, and you know with absolute certainty which 12-month-old put it there.
That grain of rice has traveled further than most people do in a week. Through the high chair, across the kitchen floor, down the hallway, into the bedroom, onto the bedding, and it's been dried, rehydrated by ambient humidity, dried again, and somehow still recognizable.
The rice grain is tiny marathon runner. And here's the thing. Hannah's actual question gets at something much bigger than just, how do I clean less? She's asking about the collision between developmental biology, cultural food practices, and modern parenting expectations. Ezra's about to turn one. He's in the thick of baby-led weaning. He devours rice, and they're finding it in their bed days later. Her question is, how do parents handle this? When does it get better? And specifically, how do rice-oriented cultures manage this when they eat rice at every single meal?
That last part is the real insight, because cultures that have been eating rice 3 times a day for millennia have already solved this problem. They've engineered their food, their tools, their environments around the reality that babies are messy and rice is uniquely terrible. We've just been reinventing the wheel, badly, with flat fabric splat mats.
Here's what we're going to do. We're going to trace that rice grain's entire journey, from the high chair to the bedroom, and understand exactly how it gets there. Then we're going to look at what Japanese, Korean, Chinese, Indian families have been doing for centuries to keep rice where it belongs. By the end, Hannah's going to have a playbook.
I should say, I'm coming at this from both sides. Retired pediatrician, so I've got the developmental biology. But also, I found rice in my own bed. This is not theoretical.
It never is with rice. That's the horror of it.
Let's actually define what we're dealing with, because rice is messy. Doesn't quite capture it. Rice has this unholy trinity of properties that make it uniquely awful as a baby food. When it's wet, it's sticky enough to adhere to skin, hair, clothing, and high chair surfaces, but not sticky enough to stay in a clump. When it dries, it becomes rock hard and detaches from whatever it was stuck to, falling off hours later in completely different locations. And when it's dry, it develops a static charge against synthetic fabrics, which is how it clings to pant legs and socks and hitchhikes to the bedroom.
The static charge thing, I'd never thought about that, but it explains the bed rice. That grain didn't fall there, it was transported.
It rode in on someone's sock. And this is where I think the framing matters. Hannah's question isn't really, how do we stop the mess? Because at 12 months, you can't. Ezra is at the absolute peak of the self-feeding mess curve. The real question is, at what developmental stage does self-feeding become clean enough that rice stops migrating to the bedroom?
Because if the answer is around 18 to 24 months, that's a very different parenting strategy than if the answer is never, you just get better at cleaning.
That's what I want to trace. There are 3 dimensions to this. First, the developmental timeline. When does fine motor control actually catch up to the demands of eating loose grains? Second, the material science. Why is rice specifically worse than yogurt or pasta or anything else we give babies? And third, and this is the one I'm genuinely excited about, cultural engineering. How do cultures that eat rice 3 times a day design their way around this problem?
The first to explain why your life is like this right now, and the third tells you what to actually do about it.
Let's start with a comparison that makes the rice problem obvious. Yogurt is messy, but it's a contained mess. It stays where it lands. Pasta can be picked up 1 piece at a time. Rice is thousands of individual projectiles, each one small enough to escape notice, sticky enough to travel, and durable enough to survive a trip through the laundry.
The yogurt stays on the high chair tray. The rice has ambitions.
The developmental piece, 12 months, is the worst possible moment for Rice. Ezra is in what we call the palmar grasp phase. He scoops food into his fist rather than using thumb and index finger. That fist compresses the rice into a sticky matrix, and then it squeezes out between his fingers like Play-Doh through a press. Every attempt to eat creates more escapees.
It's not that he's bad at eating rice. It's that his hands are literally designed wrong for rice right now, and they won't be in 6 months.
And his mouth is doing the same thing. At 12 months, babies use a tongue thrust pattern to move food back, the same motion that pushes food out. Rice, being small and loose, gets ejected with basically every swallow attempt. So you've got escape from the hands and escape from the mouth simultaneously.
A two-front rice war.
Which is why I want to get to the cultural solutions. Because those cultures understood the physics of this long before we had developmental psychology. They engineered the food itself to solve the problem. But that's the next part of the conversation. Let's get into the actual biomechanics, because understanding what's happening in Ezra's hands and mouth right now changes how you think about the mess entirely. The pincer grasp, that's thumb and index finger coming together to pick up a single grain, typically emerges somewhere between 9 and 12 months. But emerging and being reliable are two different things.
He might have the hardware, but the software is still buggy.
Full reliability, where a baby can consistently pick up small objects without dropping them, doesn't settle in until 14 to 18 months. And rice grains are among the smallest objects we ask babies to manipulate. Before the pincer grasp stabilizes, babies default to the palmar grasp. That's the whole hand scoop, fingers curling into the palm. With rice, that scoop compresses dozens of grains into a sticky little brick inside the fist. Then, as the baby opens their hand to bring food to mouth, the rice extrudes out between the fingers.
Every attempt to eat creates a secondary rice fountain.
That's the primary escape mechanism. And it's not a failure of coordination. It's the correct motor pattern for larger objects being applied to something too small for it. The brain hasn't yet mapped. Rice requires pincer as the default. It's still running the palmar grasp as the universal food acquisition program.
Which explains why the mess isn't just food falling off a spoon. It's being actively extruded.
And then there's the mouth. At 12 months, babies are still using what we call a munching pattern. It's vertical jaw movement up and down rather than the rotary chewing that comes later. They move food to the back of the mouth using a tongue thrust motion. But here's the problem. That same tongue thrust also pushes food forward and out. With a cracker or a piece of pasta, the size and cohesion keep it in the mouth. Rice, being small and loose, gets ejected with nearly every swallow attempt. You'll see it, a little spray of grains around the lips, down the chin, onto the bib.
The mouth is basically a rice catapult.
That's not even getting into the physics of what happens when rice leaves the high chair. There was a fascinating study out of the University of Michigan's Feeding Development Lab a few years back. They actually mapped food dispersal patterns from high chairs. The average high chair tray sits at about 75 centimeters off the ground. When a baby drops a handful of rice from that height, individual grains don't just fall straight down. They scatter in a radius of up to 1.5 meters.
A meter and a half. That's a dinner plate radius bigger than the baby himself.
Differential air resistance. Each grain has its own aerodynamic profile depending on orientation, and they bounce differently on impact. Some roll under cabinets. Some lodge in baseboard gaps. And then there's the delayed release phenomenon. Wet rice sticks to the tray, dries over the next few hours, and then detaches and falls. So you clean the floor at 6 p.m., and by 9 p.m., there's fresh rice under the chair.
The rice that appears in places you've already cleaned. That's the one that drives people insane.
Then there's the static transport vector. Dried rice grains rubbing against synthetic high chair fabrics or polyester blend baby clothes develop a static charge. They cling to pant legs, sleeves, sock cuffs. The baby gets lifted out of the chair, carried through the house, put down for a diaper change, and rice grains detach along the route. That's your bedroom contamination pathway.
We've got three distinct zones of rice distribution. Zone 1 is directly under the chair, the gravity zone. Zone 2 is the scatter radius from thrown or dropped handfuls. And zone 3 is anywhere in the house that someone walks after a meal.
That's the three-zone mess model, and once you see it, you can't unsee it. Zone 1 is what you clean immediately. Zone 2 is what you find with your bare feet 2 hours later. Zone 3 is the rice in the bed.
The thing that strikes me about all of this, the palmar grasp, the tongue thrust, the scatter physics is that none of it is bad parenting. It's not that Ezra is an unusually messy baby. He's a normally developing 12-month-old who's been given a food that his motor systems literally cannot handle yet.
That's the developmental inevitability piece. The mess peaks between 10 and 14 months. There's actual research on this, longitudinal studies tracking self-feeding mess across infancy. It declines sharply between 18 and 24 months as spoon proficiency develops. But here's the catch with rice specifically. Rice can't be stabbed with a fork. It requires scooping, and scooping is a later developing skill. Fork stabbing comes online around 15 to 18 months. Spoon scooping with wrist rotation doesn't stabilize until 18 to 24 months.
Rice extends the mess timeline past what you'd see with, say, pasta or vegetables.
Because even once the pincer grasp is reliable and the tongue thrust has matured into rotary chewing, the tool problem remains. You can hand a 16-month-old a fork and they'll spear a piece of chicken. Hand them a spoon for rice and they'll flip it before it reaches their mouth.
Which brings us to the question Hannah's really asking, whether she knows it or not. If the developmental timeline says rice is going to be a mess until close to age 2, and the physics says rice is uniquely good at traveling, then the only variable left to control is the food itself and the environment around it. And that's where those rice-eating cultures come in.
Let's talk about what actually works, and I mean what's worked for centuries, not what some parenting blog invented last Tuesday. The first thing to understand is that the rice Hannah's probably serving Ezra is a completely different material than what a Japanese toddler eats.
Different rice, different physics.
Short-grain japonica rice, the kind used in sushi, Korean table rice, most Japanese cooking, has amylopectin content above 80%. That's the sticky starch. Long-grain indica rice, which is what most Western kitchens default to, basmati, jasmine, has much lower amylopectin. It's designed to be separate, fluffy, individual grains.
Which is exactly what you want for a pilaf, and exactly what you don't want for a 12-month-old.
There's actual food science on this. Rice with amylopectin above 80% forms cohesive clumps that can survive a 30-centimeter drop without fragmenting. Standard long grain shatters on impact. So when Ezra drops a fistful of basmati, it's a fragmentation grenade. When a Korean toddler drops a clump of short grain, it stays a clump.
Half the mess problem is literally a rice variety problem.
That's the first thing any rice-eating culture does. They start with sticky rice, but they don't stop there. Japanese parents make onigiri for babies, tiny rice balls, about 2 centimeters across, with a strip of nori wrapped around the bottom as a handle. The baby holds the nori, eats the rice, zero loose grains. You've transformed the food matrix from thousands of individual projectiles into a single, cohesive unit.
The nori strip is edible grip. That's brilliant.
It solves the palmar grasp problem we talked about. The baby doesn't need pincer precision because they're holding a nori handle, not individual grains. Korean families do something similar with gimbap for toddlers, rice and fillings rolled in seaweed, sliced into discs. The seaweed wrapper contains everything.
The cultural solution isn't teach the baby to be cleaner. It's modify the food so the baby's natural motor patterns work with it instead of against it.
That's the core insight, and it extends to tools too. Korean baby spoons. They're called eorin. I sutgarak are just smaller versions of adult spoons. The head is angled at about 15 degrees relative to the handle. That matches the natural angle of a toddler's wrist during the scooping motion, which is different from an adult's because their radius and ulna haven't fully rotated into the adult position yet.
The spoon is engineered for the biomechanics of an 18-month-old wrist.
Japanese MAME spoons. MAME means bean, are sized for toddler hands with deeper, more curved bowls than Western baby spoons. The depth matters because it compensates for the fact that toddlers can't do the wrist supination needed to keep a shallow spoon level. A deep bowl means the rice stays in even when the spoon tilts.
Meanwhile, I'm picturing the standard Western baby spoon, which is basically just a teaspoon with a rubber coating.
A flat handle that encourages a fist grip, which is exactly the grip that dumps the spoon's contents. The engineering mismatch is almost comical once you see it.
What about the environment side? Hannah mentioned cleaning under the high chair constantly.
Japanese households use what's called a shita nishiku mono, literally thing spread underneath. It's a purpose-built waterproof mat with raised edges placed under the child's eating area. The raised edges are the key. They catch 95% of drop food. Compare that to the Western splat mat, which is typically flat fabric. Rice hits a flat mat and rolls right off the edge.
The Western version is a mat that Rice treats as a suggestion.
Then there's the floor feeding approach, which is common across India and Southeast Asia. Baby sits on the floor, food is on a banana leaf or a metal plate directly on the ground. There's no 75 centimeter drop. No gravitational potential energy to create that 1.5 meter scatter radius. The mess stays contained to maybe 50 centimeters.
The high chair creates the problem it's supposed to solve, elevation for adult convenience. But elevation is what gives rice its dispersal energy.
In those cultures, kids achieve clean rice eating by 18 to 24 months, which matches the developmental timeline we discussed, but they're not suffering through 2 years of rice migration because the food and the environment have been engineered around the baby's actual capabilities.
Hannah's real question, how do rice-oriented cultures handle this? The answer is, they don't handle the mess. They prevent the mess from being possible in the first place. Different rice, different shapes, different tools, different eating surface.
All of this is immediately actionable tonight. Switch to sushi rice or short grain. Form it into small balls. Use a mat with raised edges. The cultural engineering is fully portable. You don't need to be Japanese to make onigiri for a toddler.
The rice in the bed is not a developmental inevitability. It's a design failure. And the fix has been sitting in East Asian kitchens for about 2,000 years.
Let's pull this into a playbook Hannah can use tonight. First thing, switch the rice. If you're feeding Ezra Basmati or Jasmine, you're feeding him the maximum scatter option. Sushi rice, Calrose, any short grain japonica. The stickiness alone reduces loose grain scatter by an estimated 70%. Same aisle, different bag, totally different physics.
You don't have to change what the adults eat. Make a pot of short grain for Ezra. Keep your basmati for yourself. Two pots, one extra burner. Problem half solved before the first grain hits the tray.
Second, form the rice. Even sticky rice benefits from being shaped. Small balls, little oval patties, anything that turns loose particles into cohesive units. The nori handle trick is optional but brilliant if Ezra will tolerate seaweed. If not, just the rice ball itself is still a single object his palmer grasp can manage without extruding.
A rice ball is a rice ball. A handful of loose grains is confetti. The difference in cleanup is the difference between wiping a surface and excavating your baseboards.
Third on the immediate list, the mat under the high chair. Whatever you're using now, if it's flat fabric, replace it with something that has raised edges. The IKEA Antelope high chair actually has an optional inflatable splash guard insert, but separately you can get white clean mats with a lip around the perimeter. The lip is everything. Rice hits the lip and stops.
If you don't want to buy a specialty mat, a large plastic tablecloth from a dollar store does the same thing. Rice doesn't stick to plastic the way it sticks to fabric. After the meal, gather the corners, shake it outside.
Which brings me to the environmental hacks that close the transport loop. The rice in the bed problem, that's zone 3, the static transport zone. The single most effective intervention is changing Ezra's clothes immediately after meals. Not later, not when you remember, immediately. The static charge on dried rice means every grain clinging to a sock or pant cuff is a grain that will fall off somewhere between the kitchen and the bedroom.
Post-meal clothing change as rice containment protocol. It sounds fussy, but it's 30 seconds versus finding rice in your sheets for 3 days.
Pair that with a full coverage bib. The bumpkins or bibato style bibs, the ones with sleeves and a catch pocket at the bottom. Those catch something like 90% of drop food before it ever reaches the floor. For rice specifically, the pocket catches the mouth ejection spray we talked about, the grains that get pushed out during tongue thrust.
The bib catches the mouth rice, the mat catches the hand rice, and the clothes change catches the static hitchhikers. Three lines of defense, each one closing a different dispersal pathway.
Here's the thing I want to say to Hannah directly, because I know her, and I know she's going to wonder if she's doing something wrong. The mess is not a failure. 12 to 18 months is the rice apocalypse phase for every baby, in every culture, in every era. The difference isn't that Japanese toddlers are magically cleaner. They're not. The difference is that Japanese parents have spent centuries engineering the food and the environment, so the mess stays tolerable while development catches up.
This is the mindset shift. The question isn't, how do I stop the mess? The question is, how do I contain the mess enough to stay sane until Ezra's motor skills catch up to his enthusiasm? That reframes the whole thing from a battle you're losing to a design problem you can solve.
The developmental piece gives you a real timeline. The pincer grasp stabilizes between 14 and 18 months. Spoon proficiency with scooping, which is what Rice actually requires, settles in between 18 and 24 months. So you're looking at somewhere between 6 months and a year of active Rice management, and then it gets better. This is not forever.
6 months to a year sounds long when you're in it, but it's also finite. There's an endpoint. Ezra will not be extruding Rice through his fingers at his high school graduation.
In the meantime, the cultural adaptations are what make those 6 to 12 months survivable. Switch the rice variety, form the food, contain the environment, change the clothes. 4 things, all doable tonight. None of them requiring any special equipment you can't get at a regular grocery store.
The rice in the bed is not inevitable. It's just that nobody told Hannah the playbook.
That playbook is solid. But Hannah also asked the forward-looking question, when does it actually get better? And I think we owe her the honest next chapter, because somewhere around 14 to 16 months, the mess changes character. It stops being about motor limitations and starts being about experimentation.
The intentional food throw. That's a whole different animal.
It's easy to confuse the two. The 12-month-old dropping rice, because his palmar grasp extruded it, that's developmental mess. The 15-month-old locking eyes with you and deliberately hurling a rice ball across the room. That's something else entirely. That's a baby who just discovered cause and effect, and your reaction is the most interesting effect in the room.
How do you tell the difference? Because from the parent's perspective, rice on the floor is rice on the floor.
The giveaway is usually the eye contact. Developmental dropping is incidental. The baby's focused on the food. The drop is a byproduct. Intentional throwing comes with a look, sometimes a little smile right before the launch. The baby is running an experiment, I do this, and the big person does that. It's physics exploration, attention seeking, and satiation signaling all wrapped in one sticky fisted package.
I drop the rice. Mom's eyebrows do the thing. Solid science, honestly.
That phase, that's probably our next episode, because it deserves its own deep dive. Is it gravity experimentation? Is it a communication attempt when they're full but don't have the words? Is it just the sheer joy of watching a rice ball achieve flight? The answer is probably all three at different moments, and parents are supposed to somehow decode it in real time while wiping the floor.
That's the open question we're leaving Anna with, and ourselves. When the mess shifts from motor to intentional, what's the response? Do you ignore it and not reinforce the behavior? Do you end the meal? Do you redirect? We'll tackle that.
Before we go there, I want to close the loop on what Hannah actually asked. She's finding rice in her bed days after dinner, and she's wondering if she's doing something wrong. And the answer is, no, the rice in your bed is not a sign of failure. It's a sign that Ezra is learning. He's exploring textures, testing his hands, mapping the physics of his world one grain at a time. The rice is evidence of development, not evidence of bad parenting.
One day you'll pull back the covers and there won't be any rice, and you'll realize it's been weeks since you found any. And Ezra will be sitting at the table eating rice with a spoon like he's been doing it his whole life. And you'll miss the chaos a little.
You'll miss the tiny rice ball bandit.
Not the baseboard rice, but the phase.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1860s, a missionary in Tuvalu recorded that locals could identify a ship's arrival by the faint blue glow of Cherenkov radiation in seawater, caused by cosmic rays hitting the atmosphere above the Pacific, visible up to 3 nights before the ship itself appeared on the horizon.
So, they were detecting cosmic rays to spot ships in the 1860s, in Tuvalu. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumentop. If you've got a question like Hannah's, something you're puzzling over, email the show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon with that food-throwing deep dive. Until then, check your pillowcases.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.